My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory.
Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Brian Ballow. If you're new to the podcast, each week, along with my colleagues Nathan Connolly, Joanne Freeman, and Ed Ayers, we explore a different aspect of American history. If you're not new to the podcast, you might know that for close to 10 years, Ed and I hosted Backstory along with our good friend and colleague Peter Onuf. Peter is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Virginia. Well, I'm pleased to tell you that Peter is back with us today. Hello, Peter, and welcome back.
Hey, Brian, thanks. It's great to be here.
Peter, you're probably wondering why you're sitting in this studio. You're there to help us kick off a new series that we're doing here at Backstory. These are episodes in which all five of Backstory's hosts, yes, Peter, you are one, will look back on their time with the show and bring you, the listener, some of our favorite moments. So think of this episode as the best of Backstory, the Peter Onuf edition, which means, Peter, you need to walk us through what we'll be hearing today.
It's a pleasure, and I'm really flattered to have a whole show devoted to some of the fun I had with you and Ed and various people that I had a chance to interview. One of the great things about the show is the interview segment, especially when you got a good friend on and you got some good laughs. So I've chosen a couple of interviews and then a riff that you and Ed and I did, which was a lot of fun. So in this episode, you're going to learn how the meaning of American independence has changed over time. And you'll learn about the invention of Santa Claus in the 1820s. Brian, if I asked you to quote something from the Declaration of Independence, what would it be?
Come on, Peter. That's pretty self-evident.
Well, Brian, good for you. You got the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. I think as a serious student, you got to read the whole thing, all right? Because it gets much more interesting at the end. In fact, it's the last paragraph that's the most important, at least according to the late Pauline Mayer. And we had a nice conversation some years ago about July 4th. So, Brian, as you listen to this, you'll see what good fun Pauline and I had. And it was always fun to talk with Pauline Mayer, a great historian and a good friend. It's not always easy to do interviews. It can be hard to get a good conversation going, but never with Pauline. And on this occasion, she had some very fresh insights to share. One of the things I want you to listen for is how unimportant that quotation that you lifted from the Declaration really is. All of those ideas about equality, I know they're important to you and me and to most Americans today, but that wasn't the most important thing in 1776. It was in the last paragraph where we actually declared independence. Now you say, brilliant. That's what happened with the Declaration of Independence. No kidding. But what does it mean to be independent? Because that's the takeaway. It means that you have a people that declares independence. Where did that people come from? This is the creative magic of the Declaration of Independence, is to conjure into existence a people and a nation.
Yeah, and I got to say, Peter, that branding, calling it Declaration, you know, that's pretty smart because that really doesn't seem to fit so well with conjure, which suggests, we're not so sure about this.
Oh, you're right. I do declare. I think you got something there. So here is our conversation from the show, Independence Days. That's with a Z, folks. A history of July 4th.
When I was first asked to write a, quote, modern history of the Declaration of Independence, I turned it down. I said, that document is hyped out of all proportion to its real significance. I mean, obviously, the Declaration of Independence was important, but what was its important? And, you know, we all think of it as important for, you know, the first couple phrases of the second paragraph. But that's part of a later life of the document. The most important part of the document in the summer of 1776 was the last paragraph. And people say, the last paragraph? What's that? That's the part that da-da-da-da-da-da declared independence,
right,
you know?
Right.
And that was what was new. The statements of Enlightenment principles in the second paragraph that we all remember were not at all unique to the document. It appeared other places, most notably in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which had been drafted by George Mason and was adopted in June. So
the important parts of the Declaration at the time were all those grievances and complaints culminating in the Declaration with the fanfare that you indicated. First parts that we remember most are boilerplate, potted social contract theory.
I think that's pretty much the way it looked initially. The question is how attention turned from the last paragraph to the second paragraph, and that takes about 20 years. And I think the process of change starts in the 1790s after we have the Constitution, and we have what we remember as the Bill of Rights. What is clear is that there is nothing in either the Constitution or the First Ten Amendments that repeats those assertions that are in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. There's no statement about equality. There's nothing about natural rights that God gave all men. Now, as the children of Englishmen, and we hadn't quite stopped being the children of Englishmen in the 1790s, people felt the need of a document to cite, to ground those beliefs. And the Declaration was made to serve that function because it was the only national document that performed that function.
Pauline, one of the things I love about your book is that you ask us to think about the Declaration as a people's declaration. The people identified with these principles. Of course, they read them in different ways, and they explained them away in some cases. Is it still a people's document in the same way it was during those decades of early American history when abolitionists and women at Seneca Falls in 1848?
Used it, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is still a people's document in that people often justify whatever cause they're defending, however flaky, in terms of the Declaration right. of Independence. I mean, people send me clippings all the time. And I remember there was somebody off the coast of Maine who was having great trouble. He used to dig clams on a neighboring beach, and the town decided to make their beach residence only. And he argued he had the Constitution on his side because it said he had a right to pursue happiness, and his happiness was digging clams on the neighboring beach.
Happy as a clam.
Well, the problem is, of course, it's, among other things, it wasn't the Constitution. It was the Declaration of Independence, and it wasn't at all clear that it referred to digging clams, you know.
There seems to be a fundamental contradiction or tension. If you think about the Declaration in its own context, it makes a kind of federal state that's recognized by other powers of the earth. That's the whole point of the Declaration, is to get recognition. But as you were just saying about your clam digger, the Declaration really has a libertarian gloss now, and a document that made the state is an anti-statist text.
That's a point. That's a good point.
Yeah, so it suggests in a way that these founding texts or documents are subject to multiple infinite interpretations, of course the Constitution is, and that every generation finds its own equilibrium, ways to read those texts together.
You know, if it wasn't true, they'd be dead. I mean, this is what Lincoln said when Stephen Douglas, was saying the Declaration was meant to declare independence. I mean, historically, of course, Stephen Douglas was right. morally, Abraham Lincoln was right. Yeah. You know, he said, it is a protector of personal liberty, he said. If it wasn't that, if it just declared independence, it's history in the bad sense. That is, it's buried in the past. And he had that wonderful phrase, it's like bandages left on the battlefield after the battle is over. I mean, it's really buried in the past. You had to find new meaning in it that was relevant to your life, to his life, to the lives of people of a later time. Or it was just sort of, you know, some archival piece of leftover junk from the past, you know.
Well, thank you so much, Pauline, for helping us understand better the Declaration of Independence. It's been great talking
to you. Thank you, Peter. This was fun.
Pauline Mayer was a professor of history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the author of many books, including American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence. She died in 2013 and is greatly missed. Whoa, the holidays are over. You might even say they're history. So what better time to look at the history of the holiday season?
Well, I suppose there are worse ways we could peg that. What do you have for us, Peter?
Well, a while back, I spoke with my old friend Steve Nissenbaum about the commercialization of Christmas that began in the 1820s. In this segment, Steve Nissenbaum tells a fascinating story about how and why we invent traditions. In this case, how a holiday we think we know keeps being reinvented. You'll look at Christmas a little differently after hearing this segment.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to get ahead of this, Peter, and I really haven't listened to this for years, but as I recall, class warfare breaks out in this segment.
Yes, Brian, it's class warfare, or at least it begins that way with rowdiness on the streets, but it turns into something more interesting. It turns into a transformation of family life. It's the moment, you might say, when the kids took over. Brian and Ed help introduce this interview from our show, Naughty and Nice, the history of the holiday season.
We're talking today about the history of the so-called holiday season. When we left off, our 18th century guide, Peter, was explaining that the Puritans not only didn't celebrate Christmas, but actually made the holiday illegal, which wasn't too surprising, considering that for centuries, it had basically consisted of a multi-day bonanza of booze-fueled partying. But despite the Puritans' best attempts, people continued to celebrate Christmas the old-fashioned way well into the 19th century.
And then, in the 1820s, something began to change. Newspapers started running Christmas-themed ads for local merchants. Now, this was a new development. Buying gifts for people, after all, wasn't a part of the old Christmas. And a lot of those ads featured a certain character who was also a new addition to the holiday, St. Nicholas, a.k.a. Santa Claus, first popularized in American newspapers in the form of a poem.
"'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse."
A Visit from St. Nicholas was written in 1823 by Clement Clark Moore, a theology professor and a member of New York's very upper crust. Now, he owned a huge estate on New York's west side. He was just the kind of guy likely to be visited by Christmas beggars demanding the master's best food and drink.
"When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter."
What was the matter, of course, was that there was a little old fat man on the lawn, just the kind of guy who would have joined up with those traditional holiday beggars. Here's historian Stephen Nissenbaum.
"He's dressed in sooty fur. He's carrying what amounts to a beggar's pack on his back. He looks like a plebeian. But this particular figure of Santa Claus doesn't come to make demands. He comes to give gifts to the narrator's kids."
Now, the character of St. Nick wasn't entirely new to American audiences. He had first appeared in A Mock History of Old New York, written by Moore's good friend, Washington Irving. But that St. Nick was portrayed as he had appeared back in Holland, as a patrician bishop. It was Clement Clark Moore's defrocking of Santa that signaled the beginning of Christmas as we know it.
The simplest, really oversimplest way to put the deeper change that caused the new Christmas to come about in the 1820s was really rapid urbanization and the early stages of capitalism.
Right.
And what those two things coming together did was it took the traditional kind of begging rituals, the traditional trick-or-treat rituals, which had gone on for centuries, and it sort of intensified the tension that was involved in them. Because now, since we're dealing with densely populated cities, the poor who go around in bands are no longer poor people who are known personally to the rich people whose houses they bang the doors on. Right. Now they're an anonymous, to use a fancy word, proto-proletariat.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in the process of being transformed from traditional apprentices and clerks into what's within a generation going to become an urban proletariat.
To some extent, you're talking about changing conceptions of the social order from a notion of status and familiar position in the community to a more anonymous, something resembling what we might call class, the dangerous classes. The streets are dangerous places. And
the streets are becoming dangerous places.
But meanwhile, the other thing that's happening in the house is that children are, in effect, stepping up and demanding gifts.
Yeah.
Where did kids get off becoming kids in the way they are today?
Well, here's one way to talk about that. Those bands of roving beggars at Christmas time would have consisted of the poor, but also would have consisted rather promiscuously of young people, even sometimes young people from wealthy households. That essentially is going to risk subverting the social order in a rather profound way.
Yeah.
And so what people in New York, some very wealthy, very conservative people in New York, started doing in the 18-teens and 1820s was, in fact, to come up with a new kind of holiday that barricaded the doors, if you like, against beggars from the outside, and that then sanctioned giving gifts to your own children within the family. So what you're simultaneously beginning to get is the fortress household, the fortress family, and the whole new idea of children as people who should be deferred to. Previously, I mean, children, in a sense, had been servants within their own household.
Dependents in a household.
Dependents in the household. But on Christmas Day, given this very old tradition of inverting the social order, you know, and now limiting that inversion to the internal workings of the family itself, I think for many families, Christmas is the first moment beginning in the 1820s when you begin to sort of look at your children in a new way.
I love
that.
And
look at them as objects of affection and objects of sentiment. And I think that the new Christmas that gets devised in the 1820s is really part of that process by which the family that we know of today, the modern family, which we think of sometimes as the traditional family, itself is being invented.
Well, Steve, I want to press you on gift giving because it's so central to our modern understanding of Christmas.
Yes.
And it seems to me gifts carry a heavy burden. They're supposed to be deeply personal and sentimental expressions of the love that cements family relations.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time—
they're commodities.
Well, to put it simply, they are commodities.
Yeah.
So how have Americans, particularly in this kind of founding era of modern Christmas, how do they resolve the tension between commodity exchange? After all, that's the nasty business of the marketplace that's supposed to be what we're escaping when we turn toward the home and we're the heartless world outside. We come into the warm, sentimental bosom of our families. So how do Americans deal with the commodity status of gifts?
Yeah, it's in a phrase, Santa Claus. From the very beginning, that part of it got disguised, I mean, to use the bluntest word, by saying that Santa Claus brought these gifts. Also by the fact that they're wrapped. They're gift wrapped. They're somehow special. And so the combination of gift wrapping and Santa Claus essentially takes them out of the marketplace. They magically appear. And in fact, by 1840, you're, in a very common way, beginning to get Santa Claus used by merchants to advertise his wares. You get ads in the newspapers saying, come to Santa Claus's favorite haunt and buy these goods. And that's, of course, defeating the whole purpose. Right. And one of the really fascinating things that I found is that beginning in the 1830s, a group of wealthy Bostonians, for the most part, decided that they needed a new ritual that would decommercialize Christmas in a way that Santa had failed to do. And that new ritual was the Christmas tree. They thought mistakenly that the Christmas tree was an old German ritual in which children actually gave gifts to their parents.
Wow. Had that ever actually happened, Steve?
It apparently happened in one family in one town in northern Germany called Ratzeburg. And it so happened that that family was being visited in the 1790s by the future poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote about it in an essay that he published around 1810. And what happened is that the press started picking this up in the 1830s after the Coleridge essay got reprinted. And the fact that it was limited to his observation of a single household got lost.
And who says individuals don't matter in history, huh?
Individuals matter in history. Well, of course, Coleridge, you know, wanted to see something like that, yeah. And Americans were ready for something like that. So they decided that the Christmas tree was this pure, completely uncommercial ritual that was commonplace in Germany, which yeah. It was not.
So in a way, folk rituals were juxtaposed to commercial practices when in fact they were part and parcel of the same thing.
They were. I mean, I think that you can almost see the history of Christmas as an ongoing series of efforts to decommercialize it, and every effort to decommercialize it and purify it then becomes appropriated or co-opted.
Yeah.
You know, it's really almost inevitable.
Well, Steve, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
You're very welcome, and thank you, Peter, so much for having me on this show.
Steve Nissenbaum is Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. He's the author of The Battle for Christmas. This last segment I want to share with you comes from the show Weathering the Storm, a history of extreme weather. It's a riff with the three of us, me, you, and Ed, and in it we talk about the social impact of hurricanes.
Peter, I lost track of the number of riffs we've done together, and I got to tell you, I love each and every one of them, but I am curious as to why you picked this one.
Well, Brian, I think some of the magic of Backstory, well, I'll say all of it for me, was when the three of us were brainstorming together, when we didn't prep and we surprised each other. We had a lot of fun coming up with some new ideas and new insights right on the spot in conversation. As I like to put it, thinking with our mouths. And we came up with an idea in this particular riff on hurricanes. I mean, hurricanes just blew right through the centuries. We ended up developing a theme about the impact of hurricanes that seemed right, and you concluded it. You just brought it home, Brian, at the end when you said, you know, even though we've tried in the 20th and 21st centuries to make the world safe for all Americans, because after all, we're all created equal, it turns out that when a big storm comes along, guess who's going to benefit from it? Not you, not me. Not most of our listeners. Forgive me if you're rich. It's the rich people, okay? So that was the big theme, and it goes back to the 17th century. A big through line through our history, and who knew? It just blew me away. Well, Ed starts us off here with a question.
So I've got a question for you guys. You know, I know both of you know all about
the places where hurricanes hit, you know, right. where big storms, where the most extreme of the extreme weather that hits the United States goes. Whether it's the Caribbean of the 18th century or Brian's beloved Florida of the 20th and 21st centuries, it seemed to me that these hurricanes that blow through with such regularity must have been a great social equalizer. They must have sort of taken down the houses of the powerful and given
levelers, maybe, so to speak.
Levelers, yeah, and given other people a chance at a start. Would that be a fair supposition or not?
No. Absolutely, absolutely wrong, Ed. And the reason is this. Hurricanes and extreme weather events generally have differential impact. Now, in the West Indies, the great development in the 17th century, before my century, as plantation societies emerge in the Sugar Islands, the big development is consolidation.
Right.
It's the people who have lots of labor, lots of land, and lots of credit back in the metropolis, back in Britain. Those are the people who can ride out a storm and not only ride it out, but pick up the pieces afterward. And it's the big slaveholders who pick off the small farmers who can't rebound after extreme weather, after a hurricane. And in some ways, the places that best sustain middling sorts are the places without extreme weather in the temperate climates. And hurricanes, I think, epitomize the ways that climate encourages the rapid consolidation of wealth.
Because it would strike me the same places that would foster a hurricane also foster environments when you could grow very valuable crops.
That's absolutely the point, Ed.
Now, but Brian, you don't grow valuable crops in the 20th century and
hey,
21st century.
Tourists are our most valuable crop. And so just watch what you're saying. But I shouldn't be mean to you because actually your supposition for the 20th century is kind of correct in an aspirational way.
Great. Partial credit, that's all I ask.
Yep. And here's the partial credit. We in the 20th century aspire to great projects of equality, egalitarian projects. And we believe through construction methods and building codes on a house-by-house basis are going to make houses safe, whether they're the houses of poor people or of wealthy people. So
your
supposition is what fuels so much in the 20th century. Sadly, this does not pan out in reality. And here's why. The combination of hubris and federal insurance actually lures people to where the hurricanes are, only to see those people wiped out. Now, who benefits after that destruction?
Well, Peter's told us it's the rich.
Yeah, and the story is pretty much the same thing in the 20th century. They have access to capital. And what they tend to do is use these natural disasters to, in a way, fast forward the economy of an area. So if you had smaller houses that fishermen lived in along the Gulf Coast at the very time that fishing is becoming less economically viable, people, let's say a wealthy land developer who is trying to grow a cash crop, which is called northern tourists.
I like it.
They use that natural disaster in a way to do part of their work, clear out the land, use capital to buy up large plots of land, and really fast forward that economy to what today we call the Sun Belt.
So my question was freaking awesome because even though it turned out to be exactly wrong, it did show an important continuity across American history, which is hard to find. You know, really, things change so radically. But here's a case that extreme weather tends to create extreme social orders.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us.
And thank you, Brian, for inviting me and giving me the chance to look back at some of my favorite backstory moments. It's been terrific to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. That's going to do it for us today. We'd love to know what you thought of Peter's selections or what your favorite backstory moments have been. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities, Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.